From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The Westies were the Irish-American mob that controlled Manhattan's West Side in the 70s and 80s. They were racketeers and hitmen. Their motto, no corpus delicti, no investigation. To help dispose of corpses, they dismembered the bodies. On today's Fresh Air, journalist T.J. English tells us about the rise and fall of a savage gang. Also today, Cuban emigre writer Herberto Padilla tells us how he went from being a Castro supporter to one of Castro's prisoners. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg finds regional accents in surprising places, and jazz pianist Dave McKenna plays a spring medley. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Exercising his new presidential powers, Soviet leader Gorbachev issued his first decree tonight to block Lithuanian independence and reinforce Soviet control over the republic. NPR's Ann Garrels has this report.
The decree calls for authorities to crack down on new Lithuanian laws which defy the Soviet constitution. One being considered would set up customs posts to mark national boundaries. The decree also demands that Lithuanians turn in all firearms within 7 days, and visas for foreigners wishing to visit Lithuania are to be restricted. Senior Lithuanian officials have declared the decree invalid, with one noting, if this isn't aggression, what is? A group of conservative deputies to the Soviet parliament has asked Gorbachev to go even further by instituting presidential rule over the republic. Tonight, Lithuanian President Vytautas Landsbergis once again called on Western nations to recognize his republic's independence. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
President Bush today assured the Prime Minister of Poland that the U.S. supports the retention of the country's present borders. Mr. Bush made the statement as he welcomed Prime Minister Tadeusz Mazowiecki to the White House for a round of talks on European security and economic cooperation. The President and Mr. Mazowiecki signed a treaty designed to assure potential U.S. investors that they'll be able to operate under free market rules in Poland. The independence celebrations in Namibia have provided the backdrop for some diplomatic breakthroughs. The BBC's Mike Woldridge says the meeting between South African leader de Klerk and Soviet Minister Shevardnadze was perhaps the most significant.
The two men confined themselves to brief comments afterwards, Mr. de Klerk saying the encounter had been positive and constructive, Mr. Shevardnadze that it had been an important meeting at this crucial stage in Southern Africa and in the wider world. Mr. de Klerk has this evening had a further meeting with one of Africa's most senior leaders, President Kaunda of Zambia. Mr. Kaunda said afterwards that the contacts African leaders had had with Mr. de Klerk here did not amount to any easing of the pressure on South Africa, but in handling a matter of life and death, he said, every sensible person wanted to avoid bloodshed and create the conditions for negotiations. Mr. Shevardnadze and his American counterpart, Mr. James Baker, both had meetings with Mr. Nelson Mandela during the day, Mr. Shevardnadze saying he placed a high priority on negotiations to resolve the problems of South Africa.
The U.S. dollar closed higher today against the West German mark and the Japanese yen. Analysts say the move to the dollar was driven by continued uncertainty as the Soviet government puts pressure on Lithuania. The prospect of German currency unification has created unease about the Deutschmark, and the fall of the Japanese stock market has investors unloading yen. The U.S. stock market, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, has lost 11 points to close at 2,727.9. This is NPR. The Senate today defeated a third attempt to toughen the compromise Clean Air Bill, rejecting a proposal supporters said would cut down on urban smog. The amendment failed on a 53-46 vote after opponents argued that it would burden too many small businesses with expensive pollution control and prompt unnecessary federal interference in cities' pollution control plans. The vote marked the third unsuccessful attempt by a group of senators, mainly from urban areas, to toughen environmental controls in the compromise worked out between Senate leaders and the Bush administration. Bad news today for fallen Panamanian dictator General Manuel Noriega. A second alleged conspirator in the drug smuggling case against him is offering to plead guilty as part of a plea bargain with federal prosecutors. NPR's Alan Tomlinson has more on today's proceedings from Miami.
Former Panamanian Army Colonel Luis del Cid is accused of conspiring with Noriega to smuggle cocaine into the United States. Federal prosecutors describe him as Noriega's courier and his liaison with Colombian drug traffickers. Del Cid's Miami attorney, Sam Burstyn, revealed today that his client is close to an agreement with prosecutors over a plea bargain. He would not disclose details of the deal, nor would he say whether Del Cid is preparing to give evidence against his former boss in return for a reduced sentence. Like Noriega, Del Cid faces up to 20 years in prison if convicted on the most serious charge against him. If an agreement is reached, the former colonel would become the second of five other defendants in the Noriega affair to enter a guilty plea. Miami, I'm Alan Tomlinson reporting.
A bill to restrict the possession and use of U.S.-made semi-automatic assault rifles advanced another step today in the U.S. House. The bill passed out of the Crime Subcommittee chaired by its sponsor, New Jersey Democrat William Hughes. Hughes said the rapid-firing weapons are coming into increasing use by drug dealers and criminals. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Former federal prosecutor Rudolph Giuliani once called the Westies the most savage organization in the long history of New York City gangs. The Westies were the Irish-American mob that ruled the neighborhood known as Hell's Kitchen on Manhattan's west side. The Westies were also contract killers. In fact, a Westie was the star witness in the recent trial of New York crime boss John Gotti. The Westie testified that his group provided the hitmen for the murder in question. The Westies have their roots in the days of Prohibition. The gang became known as the Westies in the mid-70s when Jimmy Coonan took over the gang and brought in ex-con Mickey Featherstone as his right-hand man. In 1986, Featherstone testified against the Westies in a RICO trial that broke up the organization and sent the leaders to prison. Featherstone is now in the Witness Protection Program. My guest, T.J. English, is the author of a new book about the Westies. The book is based on information from over 100 hours of interviews with Featherstone, interviews with other gangsters, cops, lawyers, and neighborhood people, as well as transcripts from the trial. English covered the trial for the Irish Voice. He told me why he's been following the story of the Westies.
For a number of years, I've been writing for Irish publications here in New York City, an Irish newspaper and an Irish magazine that comes out of New York. And I had heard of the Westies. They were a crime story that wouldn't go away here in New York City. Occasionally they would pop up in the headlines. They were a violent gang and an influential gang. But the thing that really interested me personally in it was where they fit in an Irish-American cultural context. The history of the gang, what they meant in terms of Irish-American culture, because the history of this gang really stretched back to Prohibition and before, really, to around the turn of the century.
Are you suggesting in a way that the gang was a way to get things that couldn't be gotten more legally, more legitimately because of discrimination?
Well, I think the gang was initially the extension of an immigrant culture. I mean, the Irish are not totally unique in this. Many immigrant groups in early stages in the United States engage in some kind of organized crime. We're seeing it now with Colombians and Jamaicans and some of the Asians. The Irish, around the turn of the century and into the Prohibition years, when organized crime as we know it today began to flourish, were commonly hired out as hitmen by what came to be known as La Cosa Nostra, the Italian syndicate. I think that the Westies were the last of a long line of Irish gangsters going back to those early stages. And this gangsterism, which has its roots in an immigrant culture, was their inheritance. And although they were themselves third and fourth generation, this is what was passed along to them.
How did the Irish mob, the Westies, get the reputation of being the hitmen?
Well, back in the 20s and 30s, when Lucky Luciano formed an organized crime commission and La Cosa Nostra, the five families of New York and that we're also familiar with now, first began, the Irish were often known as the guys who would do the dirty work, who would pull the trigger, and they were used occasionally. This was the source of their power on the west side of Manhattan. Hell's Kitchen was not a predominantly Irish neighborhood. There was certainly had an Irish element to it, but the Irish rose in this community because they were willing to do some of the most vicious killings, some of the killings that no one else would do. And this also was the Westies' inheritance. I mean, they were the Westies, this latest generation of Irish-American gangsters, really were known for their violence. They upped the ante quite a bit.
What was it that the Westies controlled in Manhattan?
Well, their neighborhood, known as Hell's Kitchen, runs from 34th Street to 59th Street, from 8th Avenue over to the Hudson River, really midtown Manhattan over on the river. It's the waterfront. It used to be a very thriving dockyard, one of the most thriving dockyards in the world in its day in the post-World War II years. Also, loan sharking, extensive loan sharking in that part of town, sports gambling. A lot of unions are centered in that part of town, and union extortion really was the backbone of the Westies. And murder for hire.
Now, in the area of murder for hire, one of their specialties was disposing of the body in such a way that it would never be found. How would they do that?
Well, it depends on how detailed you want to get about that. They, by using simple kitchen utensils, kitchen knives, they cut up the bodies and put them in plastic bags and dumped them in the East River. This became their signature. They called it making the murder victim do the Houdini. They got rid of the bodies. And Jimmy Coonan, who was the leader of the Westies, had a philosophy which was no corpus delicti, no investigation. You get rid of the body, you have no criminal investigation. So, you know, the average person on the street would be horrified by the idea of dismemberment, and it is pretty horrifying. But, you know, if you kill people for a living, getting rid of the body is a fairly practical thing to do. I know that sounds cavalier, but I think initially the reason they cut up the bodies was simply because it was good business practice.
It's interesting, though, some of the real toughened criminals who you're writing about would have no trouble pulling the trigger, but when it came to watching the dismemberment, they would lose their lunch.
Well, that's a whole new ball game, starting to cut up a body. I mean, I know a lot of these gangsters who could kill someone, could pull a trigger, might even be able to stab someone, but cutting up a body, I mean, you can imagine the blood and, you know, it's very distasteful. Some of them were never able to cross that line. Jimmy Coonan, the leader of the gang, crossed that line and really flourished on the other side for quite a number of years. He seemed to have no problems cutting up the bodies.
My guest is journalist T.J. English, and he's written a new book on the Irish mob in New York's Hell's Kitchen, and it's called The Westies. The people in the Westies, where did they fit in the community in Hell's Kitchen? I mean, not everybody in that community was a gangster. Was their work basically known, and was it accepted by other people in the community?
It was known, and it was feared, basically. There had always been tough guys in Hell's Kitchen. There had always been a group of guys who engaged in crime. No one ever really thought of them as a gang. It was a kind of a loose collection of loan sharks and gamblers and assorted other criminals. There was a code in Hell's Kitchen called the West Side Code, which meant you didn't talk. I mean, there were a lot of murder investigations, needless to say. There were bodies disappearing on the West Side, and cops would come around asking questions, and people would clam up. The West Side Code was deeply, deeply embedded in the neighborhood. I think that most people in the neighborhood, although they knew there were these gangsters and they heard the rumors and the stories, really had no idea of the level of the violence. And it really wasn't until that RICO trial, when Mickey Featherstone flipped and a couple others flipped, that the true horror and terror that the Westies had wrought on the west side of Manhattan came to light. And so I think that everyone, there was no one living in that neighborhood that had not heard of Mickey Featherstone and Jimmy Coonan and what they were all about. Most people chose to look the other way.
How did an alliance form between Irish organized crime and Italian organized crime in New York?
The alliance first began in 1931 again with Lucky Luciano's Organized Crime Commission. It was an uneasy alliance over the years. The Italians and the Irish were frequently suspicious of each other. And as the the Irish waned in organized crime, and the Italians actually flourished with the five families of New York, the relationship almost became one of, let's say, a small firm would be to a large corporation. The Irish guys never really trusted the Italians, and it was Jimmy Coonan who, I think, realized that the Irish gang on the west side of Manhattan would become extinct if they did not reinforce this tie with the Italian organized crime. And it was Jimmy Coonan who made moves to forge an alliance with the Gambino crime family in the mid and late 1970s. And this caused a good deal of resentment amongst some of his own gang members and really sowed the seeds of their demise in a way.
The Westies figured into the John Gotti trial that ended in February of this year when Gotti was acquitted. Gotti is the head of New York's most powerful organized crime family, the Gambino family. And the charges were for the shooting of John O'Connor of the Carpenters Union. Someone from the Westies was the star witness in this trial, Jimmy McElroy. And he alleged that the Westies were used as the hitmen against O'Connor, the Carpenters Union guy. You covered the trial. You were there.
Mm-hmm.
What's the significance of this trial in the Westies story?
Well, there is a history to this. When Paul Castellano was killed in December of 1985, Castellano at that time was the head of the Gambino family, and he was shot down in Midtown Manhattan. And the shooting was always believed to have been sanctioned by John Gotti, who then became head of the family. The Westies had always had the alliance with Paul Castellano. When Castellano was taken out of the picture, Jimmy Coonan wanted to make it clear to John Gotti that he could be dealt with. And at a wake for a Gambino underboss named Frankie DiCicco, Jimmy Coonan and Jimmy McElroy were there, and they went up and they met John Gotti and another member of the Gambino family, and they were told that they were having a problem with a union official named John O'Connor, and that they wanted to teach John O'Connor a lesson, but they were having problems getting the job done. According to McElroy, Jimmy Coonan volunteered their services to do this shooting. O'Connor was an Irish guy, an Irish-born union official. The union local that he worked for was in straddled Hell's Kitchen. So they offered to do the job. And according to Jimmy McElroy and a version of another Westie, Mickey Featherstone, Kevin Kelly was the trigger man, and they shot John O'Connor as a favor for John Gotti, to establish a relationship with John Gotti.
Now, Gotti was acquitted on this trial. How do you think Gotti got off?
Well, it was a bad case. The government had a weak case. They really didn't deserve to win it. There were a couple problems. One of them was Jimmy McElroy. After Jimmy McElroy was convicted in the last Westies RICO case and was given 60 years with no parole, he decided to flip and cooperate with the government. Jimmy McElroy was always known as probably one of the least bright of not a very bright group of guys. McElroy was, even his girlfriend called him, on one wiretap, called him a bellhead, meaning, I suppose, that there wasn't much upstairs. McElroy flipped. There was a suspicion that he was going to be a terrible witness. I mean, this is a guy who really has problems stringing two sentences together. He brought a terrible resume along with him. He was a pretty horrible killer and criminal. And he proved to be a disastrous witness on the stand, and he really was the key witness for the government. And he also seemed to be lying in a number of different areas, and this came to light throughout the trial.
I'm wondering, since it was a Westie who was the chief witness against John Gotti in the Gotti trial, do you think that there's any chance that there are any, like, former Westies and mafiosi in the same jail and that there'd be some kind of feud or war going on between them in the prison?
Well, it's possible, sure. Jimmy McElroy would be in protective custody because he was a government witness. They would keep him in a protective wing of the prison. He would not be in general population. But there would be other members of the Westies who were convicted in the RICO trial a few years ago that, yeah, would be in general population along with Italians. My guess is that they would do their best to stay away from each other. I've heard through my sources that Jimmy Coonan, who is now in Leavenworth for 75 years with no parole, the Italians don't want to have anything to do with them, and Jimmy Coonan has started hanging out with the Aryan Nation guys at Leavenworth. You always have to hang out with somebody, and Jimmy always hung out with the Italians, but they won't have anything to do with him anymore.
Well, let's talk some more about organized crime after we take a short break. My guest is journalist T.J. English, and he's the author of a new book called The Westies about the Irish mob in New York's Hell's Kitchen. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
We're talking about organized crime with journalist T.J. English. The person who was the chief source for a lot of the information in your book is Mickey Featherstone, and he was one of the Westies who turned for the RICO trial that convicted the Westies. Now, Featherstone had been diagnosed in a veterans hospital as being paranoid schizophrenic. It must have been a difficult source for you to use.
Well, he was a difficult source in a way. I mean, I had to cross-check everything that I used from Mickey Featherstone's point of view. But in terms of the factual things in the book, it wasn't as difficult as you would think, because when Mickey Featherstone flipped and started to cooperate with the government, this led to a chain reaction, and there were a number of other gang members who also flipped. The thing that was more difficult was at times, Mickey Featherstone gets into a kind of paranoia and bitterness that makes it difficult to really pin him down on anything. The anger festers in him a lot. And when I got around to talking to him, he was in prison, and at that time he was angry at the government. He felt they were reneging on his deal with them. They weren't giving him some of the things they promised they were going to give him. Conjugal visits and furloughs and this sort of thing. So he was constructing a whole new conspiracy theory in his head, this one involving the government. He was constantly throughout his life constructing conspiracy theories.
If I'm not mistaken, most of the interviews, or perhaps all of the interviews that you did with Featherstone, were conducted by telephone, not in person.
Yes.
Was that because he was under the Witness Protection Program?
Well,
were there other reasons for that?
Now, when we first began talking, he was still in prison. He was in the protective custody wing of the prison. He had just finished testifying at the Westies trial, and he had not yet been sentenced on his racketeering charge. You see, the deal he made with the government was he agreed to cooperate and to testify, and yet he still had to plead guilty to a RICO charge. So he was going to be sentenced on this. He hadn't been sentenced yet. He was awaiting sentencing. And he was in prison at the time, and he would call me from prison. And really, at this point, he had no friends other than his wife and his children. I mean, even his brothers and sisters, no one would talk to him. Mickey had become a rat, which is the lowest of the low. So I think I was probably one of the few people he had to talk to. There were some times when he would call two and three times a day. And usually it was just to let off steam. You know, he was incarcerated. He felt that he was getting screwed by the government, and he was angry. Eventually, he got sentenced, and he got probation. He walked, and needless to say, that did great things for the anger he was feeling towards the government. Then he disappeared into the Witness Protection Program, and he would continue to call me from wherever he was in the United States. At first, I thought this would be a difficulty. I was obsessed with meeting Mickey Featherstone. If I was going to write about the guy, I really wanted to shake his hand and look into his eyes and whatever. But after a while, I began to appreciate the distance between us, because Mickey's a very charming guy. And after all, it was not a book about Mickey Featherstone. And had I got to see him and spend time with him, I have a feeling that he might have been more influential in the writing of the book than he should have been. So it was good to have that distance in a way.
You know, the neighborhood that you write about, New York's Hell's Kitchen, has really changed a lot over the decades. And in the 80s, part of that neighborhood became very gentrified. And old bars were turned into cafes.
Yeah.
Like really, you know, nice restaurants. Apartment buildings sprung up in a lot of that area. How did the gentrification affect the gang?
It played a big role. There are people who contend today that the gentrification had more to do with doing away with the Westies than law enforcement did. Not only gentrification, but really what we're talking about is the death of a certain kind of community, a working class community, more specifically an Irish working class community, the likes of which are really isn't seen anymore. I mean, the Irish have long since assimilated and headed towards the suburbs, and the Irish community in Hell's Kitchen really was kind of a throwback to another era. And the gentrification thing eradicated finally, once and for all, what was left of that community. And many of the hardcore families who had been there for generations moved to New Jersey or to Westchester County, north of the city. And most of the bars that these guys hung out in, the bars and the delis and the diners, which was where they did a lot of their business, began to disappear and were replaced by fern bars and yuppies hung out there. And there was this natural evolution that really had a lot to do with changing the community that the Westies flourished in and really sort of diminishing it. And in some ways, I tend to think that the violence, the outrageous violence that we associate with the Westies, in some ways was almost like the violent last death throes of a certain community that was being eradicated by gentrification.
At the beginning of our conversation, you told us that one of the reasons why you wanted to investigate the Westies was to understand what this gang meant in terms of Irish-American culture. Do you ever get any resistance from Irish-Americans about focusing too much on crime? You know, perhaps making Irish-Americans look bad by showing the criminal element within the culture?
Well, I haven't yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if I do. There's a couple things there. First of all, I'm Irish-American myself, and I think it was important that this book be written by an Irish-American, that it was written by someone who was trying to understand the violence in terms of the community and not just saying it was crazy killers, that there were social and historical reasons that brought about this violence. As far as make it, whether or not it makes the Irish look bad, I don't know. The Irish have been in this country for a long time, and they've achieved great things in every conceivable field and endeavor. We had an Irish Catholic president. I really think we're long past the stage of having to be defensive about that. I mean, I'm not suggesting that the Westies are in any way emblematic of Irish-American culture. I'm just suggesting that they're an aspect of Irish-American culture.
Listen, thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure. My pleasure.
T.J. English's book on the demise of the Irish mob in New York is called The Westies. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, sports journalist Alexander Wolf and Armin Katane, their new book, Roar Recruits, is an expose of college basketball recruitment practices. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When he was in college, poet Herberto Padilla used to discuss literature with his friend Fidel Castro. Padilla's early support of the Cuban Revolution turned to disillusionment. Padilla was imprisoned for being a counter-revolutionary. Coming up, we talk with the poet about his imprisonment and his immigration to the U.S. Also, pianist Dave McKenna helps us welcome spring. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg describes some California accents more enduring than valley speak. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The White House indicated its concern today about reports from the Soviet Union that President Gorbachev had ordered citizens of Lithuania to turn in their weapons. Press Secretary Marlon Fitzwater said, "It's a matter we are watching seriously." Earlier, Secretary of State Baker was told by Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze that Moscow would not intervene with force to block Lithuanian independence. The Parliament of Lithuania voted last week to declare independence from the Soviet Union. In Romania, the armed forces have restored an uneasy calm to the town of Târgu Mureș after 4 days of violence there. Local officials and the government continue to disagree over the number of people killed during the fighting. Kathleen Hunt reports from Bucharest.
A calm but tense atmosphere surrounds the northern town of Târgu Mureș as some 1,500 soldiers keep rival groups of Romanians and ethnic Hungarians apart. No new casualties have been reported today. Provincial authorities repeated their earlier claim of 6 dead and 300 injured, although the government in Bucharest has reduced the death toll to 3. This week's violence is the worst seen here since the Second World War, and it's the most serious threat to the fragile stability of President Ion Iliescu's provisional government. It's brought relations with neighboring Hungary to an all-time low, and it's prompted the United States to state that it deplores the provocation and violence by all parties. But potential for a nationalist backlash seems to be growing here, as Romanians sweep through the capital, shouting slogans in solidarity with their fellow Romanians in Transylvania. For National Public Radio, this is Kathleen Hunt in Bucharest.
In the U.S., research in the latest issue of the New England Journal of Medicine finds that eating fish oil can lower your blood pressure. NPR's Michael Scholar has more.
In the new study, people with high blood pressure took capsules of concentrated fish oil every day for 10 weeks. And on average, their blood pressure readings dropped by 4 or 5 points. That's not a big drop, but it's enough to cut significantly the risk of getting a stroke or heart attack. The new study, done in Norway, is the latest in a series that show fish oil lowers blood pressure. And experts say the oil could become an important substitute for some of the blood pressure drugs now on the market. In the new study, volunteers got a hefty dose of fish oil every day, as much oil as in a pound or more of fatty fish, like salmon or mackerel. But there's some evidence that just eating fish several times a week might also make a difference in blood pressure. Doctors aren't yet ready to push fish oil supplements, but most health organizations have long been pushing more frequent fish meals. This is Michael Scholar in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down almost 11 points to close at 2,727.93, volume 131 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Dave McKenna has been described as the hardest swinging pianist of all time. He also has one of the largest repertoires of songs. He once told jazz critic Whitney Balliot that he likes to pass time away while he's playing by free associating song titles in medleys. We asked him to do that for us as a way of celebrating the beginning of spring.
Thank you.
Dave McKenna's latest recording is called Live at Maybeck Recital Hall. It's on Concord Records. fresh air. Roberto Padilla was once at the center of literary life in Cuba. He was a journalist, translator, and prominent poet before he became disillusioned with the revolution. In his poems, he started to criticize the dictatorship of his former friend, Fidel Castro. In 1971, Padilla was jailed for being a counter-revolutionary. He was interrogated and beaten. After his release, a month later, he was forbidden to publish his own writing. In 1980, he was allowed to leave Cuba, and he emigrated to the United States. In his recently published memoir, Self-Portrait of the Other, Padilla recounts his time spent in jail and how Castro visited him at a military hospital where Padilla was recovering from his prison beating. I asked him what Castro had come to talk about.
Castro is a very contradictory personality. I mean, he wanted to talk to me and to convince me that I was an enemy of something which was very important for me in the past. A revolution. I didn't discuss anything with him. It's very difficult to discuss with the power in a jail. He did not accept me to be a counter-revolutionary, you know. Anyway, it's difficult for anyone to be a counter-revolutionary. It's a very heavy word for a man who has loved the idea of the left.
When you were in jail, you were told that they would release you if you wrote a self-criticism. Is there any difference between self-criticism and a confession?
Well, certainly. A confession means that you have committed? No, that's not the word in English.
Well, committed a crime.
A crime. Mm-hmm. I committed a crime. I didn't commit any crime. No, I was considered, let's say, although I don't like the word, a politician, a Cuban writer, with political ideas. So there is a great difference between self-criticism and confession.
Now, I think many people would have refused to write the self-criticism. You agreed to do it. Why did you agree?
Because, exactly, I want to. Because I was living in a communist country. In my case, the Cuban Revolution didn't decide to put me in jail. They wanted me to tell to the people that I was not right. It's not a question of weakness of character or something like it. It is a question of being a revolutionary. Of course, I did not believe that when knowing that I didn't do anything against the Cuban Revolution. I was forced or invited to recognize mistakes or crimes I did not commit. So I tried to say something to my friends abroad, the only possibility I had, to demonstrate by parody that this was a false confession or a false self-criticism. So I exaggerated that, and everybody understood that. Don't forget that I was not living in the United States. I was living in Cuba.
So you're saying that you used the self-criticism as an opportunity to send a message to people outside the country that you were being forced to make a statement.
Clearly translated.
What did you say in your self-criticism?
The general idea of this speech, or whatever you want to call it, was that I spoke with foreigners, and I was irresponsible when I spoke with them because I criticized Fidel Castro and I criticized many aspects of Cuban Revolution. And this was a great mistake. I also mentioned to many of my friends who knew perfectly what I was saying because they came to this meeting and they accept what I said. All of these friends of mine also made mistakes. That was all. I didn't want to appear like a criminal, a common criminal. I wanted to appear as a man who was not loyal to Castro, you know. And Fidel Castro and many other people in the history of the world accepted, because this shows that you are a weak man, that you are a coward, and that's all. But I was sure that it was necessary to do, because it showed to the world that Castro was a dictator, that many other people, that he preferred to have in prison a man who was not loyal to him like a person, but without committing any crime. I'm sorry.
No, so you felt that by making this self-criticism, you demonstrated that Castro was a dictator, but Castro, on the other hand, felt he won by demonstrating that you were a coward by giving in and writing this.
I think so.
Did you feel like you were being a coward? Did you ever have any regrets about it?
Well, I'm basically a coward. Why not? I'm not a hero. And I don't like heroes. I accept heroes sometimes. For example, if you are in a lake and you are dying and there is someone who wants to save you, well, I would say that's nice. I mean, I would do the same thing. But when you translate that, when you extend that attitude to politics, it means that you are superior to your own people. I always remember the line in the Bertolt Brecht play about Galileo, when one of his friends said to him, "Oh my, you confess your crime, but at the same time you save the truth for history." He said, "So you are a hero?" He said, "No, I'm not a hero. Poor the country that needs heroes."
What's wrong with heroes, though? I mean, well, heroes are an inspiration for you to behave well, for you to put certain personal, selfish things aside and work for the larger good.
No, that's moving literature for the free country, for example, United States. But that's not my opinion.
When Castro told you that you could leave the country, he said to you, "But don't get the idea that happiness is waiting for you on the other side. Your exile will be nothing like what you think it will be." Was he right?
He was right, indeed. I'm not happy.
You're not happy?
No.
Why not?
Because I suffer when I see my country with that man who could be a positive leader of my country and making mistakes every day. And also, I'll tell you openly that in this country, when I have, for example, I have been in many universities, you know, there are many Stalinists, people who want the Cuban Revolution to be still the same thing. And so they don't like Cubans who are coming from Cuba to the United States. I also agree that I should have been there in my country fighting or saying whatever I wanted and never to come to the United States. That's what I think. You don't agree.
Well, you're saying that you think that there's a lot of Americans who don't want to hear that the Cuban Revolution went wrong.
Well, I don't think Americans. I would say scholars, which is different. I mean, if I speak with anyone in the street, the opinion of these people are very different. But in the United States, there are many scholars who are afraid of being American. Let's say that. They don't want to be oppressive to any other country. For example, they love Nicaragua or Salvador or Cuba, Fidel Castro. They don't consider that we have a dictatorship there.
Well, let me ask you something that Gabriel Garcia Marquez said to you when you told him, and he was the head of a human rights group at the time, that you wanted to leave the country. He said, "You've chosen a bad moment. If you go to Spain now, there are plenty of Cuban counter-revolutionaries waiting there to turn you into a symbol." Were you concerned about that, of being used by a symbol, either by the right or the left?
I'm very concerned. I do not believe to any political organization of Cubans. So I would say that in that aspect, he was right. There were many people waiting for me, and I discovered that when I came to Spain and then to Canada and to the United States. But what can I do? I mean, I want to live. I'm not a politician. Politics was something that happened in my life, But I have never been a politician.
So you don't want to be seen as someone on the right. You don't want your cause to be a cause of the right.
No. I don't want to be... I don't want to have a country on my shoulder, you know, like in the poem of Coleridge, instead of cross, the albatross. Do you remember that? The albatross is part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
That country and that problem. Because I'm here talking to you, I don't know why, but probably for that reason, isn't that? You don't say anything about poetry. You don't ask me any question about Auden, T.S. Eliot, my love for English poetry. You don't want to.
Well, just for the record, I should say here that I asked you to read some of your poems in English translation, and understandably you said to me that you felt uncomfortable reading it in English because you were uncomfortable with your pronunciation.
Exactly.
So, and then I decided I was uncomfortable reading it because I don't read poetry that well. So we haven't had any of your poetry read.
But you can read it.
For that reason. Yeah, yeah. Is the writing that you're doing now set in Cuba, or is it set in the United States?
Well, the poems are set in everywhere, but the novel, no, it is not set in the United States, in Cuba. No. But in an island of the West Indies. And this island, where this man wants to live, is also affected by history, by problems. He wants to get away from history, but he's condemned to suffer that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you. Poet and novelist Herberto Padilla. His new memoir, Self-Portrait of the Other, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel is with us. Robert, what stories do you have coming out of the Soviet Union?
We'll have more on the announcement by Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev that there'll be a collection of all firearms in Lithuania. Lithuania is, of course, the Baltic Republic that's declared its independence, and there's been a great deal of psychological pressure brought to bear on the Lithuanians by Moscow. We'll hear what's happening with that story. Also, in Romania, in Transylvania, which is part of Romania, where many, many ethnic Hungarians live, there's been some rioting, and a couple of ethnic Hungarians have been killed. And we'll have a report from Soviet Moldavia about the fears of what may become of Romanian nationalism there.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg is a transplanted New Yorker now living in California. His hometown is famous for its accents, but Jeff has found plenty of diversity in the way Californians talk.
Here in San Francisco, spring is apparently in the air. At least the ranunculus and the Japanese plum trees have begun to respond to some sub-threshold climactic changes that passed me right by. Whatever you may have heard, California's really a very subtle place. Out here, you have to strain to perceive distinctions that fairly holler at you back east. Take accents. Eastern accents are as distinct as eastern seasons. They're written on the names of the places themselves. Boston has Harvard Yard. New York has 33rd and Park. Philadelphia has 4th and South. And within each locality, further distinctions of class, ethnicity, and age are marked on every vowel. One New Yorker gets a bead on another the second he hears him say chocolate, or chocolate, or chocolate, or chocolate, as the case may be. We Easterners are conscious of accents. We know that they place us in every sense of the term. When I moved to the West Coast 11 years ago, I was struck by how little attention Californians seemed to pay to these things. People out here didn't even think they had accents. Now, of course, that isn't possible. Accents are like hair colors and shoe sizes. Everybody's got one. But I think that what people meant was that there weren't any accent differences out west, that everybody spoke the same. And I can see why they would think this. After all, California was supposed to be the place where all those other American accents came to mix and mellow out. But in fact, people have been predicting the end of regional accents for more than 100 years now, whether because of universal conscription, population movements, radio, or TV. And yet, accent differences persist and flourish, even here in the newest world. The emergence of accents is inevitable because they're shaped in the mouths of children and teenagers. Kids are not interested in sounding like Tom Brokaw or Diane Sawyer, no more than they want to dress like them. Kids are fundamentally tribal. They want to talk like their crowd and differently from the other crowd. Over the course of time, the result is a natural divergence in the accents of neighborhoods, cities, and regions. So it isn't surprising that California should have its own local accents. You can tell a San Franciscan from somebody in Oakland or Berkeley by the way they say the vowel in a word like fog, for example. It's fog in the city and fog in the East Bay. Actually, these days, it's usually fog in the city and sun in the East Bay, which is probably what's got the ranunculus all stirred up. But like plants, these accents have led mostly secret lives. It wasn't until a couple of years ago that the Southern California accent was dragged out of the closet to be celebrated by the Beach Boys and by Moon Unit Zappa in her song Valley Girl.
Grody, grody to the max, I'm sure. It's like really nauseating. Like, bark out, gag me with a spoon. Gross. I am sure. Totally.
Of course, expressions like grody to the max are just local adolescent slang, but there was a real regional accent behind those fronted vowels in words like totally and good, an accent that had been simmering for years all over the southern part of the state. For the first time, Americans realized that Southern California wasn't just a place that people went to, it was a place that people came from, whose inhabitants had their own voice and their own curious native charm. But up here in the Bay Area, people still deny that they have accents. Maybe this has to do with San Francisco's self-conscious cosmopolitanism and its obsession with L.A. San Franciscans are always telling you how their city is much more like the great cities of the East in Europe than it's like that la-la land down south. They have a grown-up's pride of place, but no ear for their own tribal voice.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produce the interviews on Fresh Air. Our research assistants are Rich Banowitz and Lou Jean DeJoseph. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In 1979, Tim O'Brien's novel about Vietnam won the National Book Award. On the next Fresh Air, O'Brien tells us about his new book on Vietnam. Also, journalists Alexander Wolf and Armin Katayan tell us how street agents and sneaker companies have taken control of college basketball recruiting. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.